Welcome to Chapter 3, Conversations about the State of Things Now.
What did you think of the self-driving car?
Love it, all day long.
Right.
And when those bad boys are made, look, the way to think about it and the magic of self-driving vehicles is that the reason Uber could be expensive is because you're not just paying for the car, you're paying for the other dude in the car.
Right? Who's driving?
Who's driving?
Yeah.
That's right. And so when there's no other dude in the car, the cost of taking an Uber anywhere becomes cheaper than owning a vehicle.
Right.
And so the magic there is that you basically bring the cost down below the cost of ownership for everybody, and then car ownership goes away.
Right. People are such a pain in the neck.
Owen Thomas from ReadWrite. Travis, you have a lot of dudes and women driving for Uber right now.
Correct.
They're probably not going to be thrilled to hear that you plan to replace them with robots as soon as you can. How are you going to manage that transition from people-driven cars to driverless cars?
Look, I think the thing to keep in mind is it's quite a ways off first. So this is not something that's happening anytime in the near future. But if I were talking to one of the drivers we partner with, what would I say? I'd say, look, this is the way the world's going to go. And if Uber doesn't go there, it's not going to exist either way. So, that's the world. And the world isn't always great. Like, sometimes you get in an accident and you didn't cause it. But that's just the way of the world. It's the way of technology and progress. And unfortunately, we all have to find ways to change with the world.
Welcome to Chapter 3. That was Travis Kalanick, co-founder and former CEO of Uber at the 2014 Code Conference. Notice that his last answer assumes a technological determinism, that the technology that is being developed is inevitable, as if it was a force of nature and not a reaction to a series of decisions and policies. Also, it is worth remembering that the phrase gig economy did not really exist until after 2009, after the introduction of the iPhone and a large economic crash. With the pandemic and the effects it will have on the economy, how we think about work will certainly keep changing at a much faster pace. But what are we building?
I don't know. Thinking about like the new structures of corporations, there are like a lot of things that were formed in that time period. And so then thinking about now, 140 years later, like what are some of the new structures that are being formed now? How is that changing our lives?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I got turned on to the Luddites by teacher of mine in undergrad, Robin Paris, and the class was a web design, like an intro to web design course. And she handed us all a chapter out of Kirkpatrick Sale's book, Rebels Against the Future. And I didn't know at that time that, Luddite was a pejorative word only in the vocabulary for me. But the thing that was interesting also to me about reading about them was that they're one of many, many, many movements that turned violent as a result of spending a lot of time petitioning to redress their grievances and being completely ignored or sort of having their concerns subjugated to the concerns of the mill owners and capitalists. So they didn't start smashing down the doors of factories and smashing the looms inside and attempting to shoot people until they'd been so backed into a corner that their livelihoods were on the line. The Luddite movement gets cast as this, a bunch of people who basically didn't want change to happen. And that's the root of the derogatory term now. But really, it's several different communities of people who were so backed against a wall that they kind of freaked out. And that happens historically. And they freaked out in many other ways, too. There were a lot of riots and markets. It tended to be women leading the riots and in food markets and men leading the nighttime raids against the factories, for whatever reasons. And people they were attacking the capitalist structure at that time, only because it was basically destroying everything that they knew about how to be a community. So they were against machinery hurtful to the commonality only.
in the 1920s and 30s, especially in Europe, a new school of Marxists began to look at traditional Marxism and said, you know, there's something really superficial about Karl Marx and Frederick Engels and their analysis of how things work. Yeah, you know, the capitalist class has armies and it has the police force and all of that. But, you know, in the great scheme of things, they are only used in the last recourse when things get out of hand. Most of the time, you don't need them. And you don't need them because most of the time, people accept what's going on the way the society is. People think that rebellion, things like 1877, happens when things get really, really bad. And they say, well, if things get bad enough, there's going to be a revolt. Well, if that were the case, the entire history of humanity would be one long history of rebellion and revolt and revolution, because the entire history of humanity has been a history of exploitation and suppression. Something like the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution is so rare that when it happens, you have to explain it. Wow, let's write a doctoral dissertation, and in fact, 1,000 doctoral dissertations on the origins of the French Revolution, the origins of the Russian Revolution. Why did these things happen? Well, they're so rare because most people accept the way things are. And that's the way most societies work. And so a new school of Marxist theoreticians in Germany called the Frankfurt School, people like Herbert Marcuse and Adorno, in Italy, Antonio Gramsci, they said, the ruling class really rules because they dominate people's minds. And the famous quote from Antonio Gramsci is, the ruling ideas of an age are the ideas of the ruling class. The first struggle is to create a counterculture, which is very, very difficult. But you cannot fight something with nothing. The only thing that can oppose an idea, which is in America, we're all middle class and we're all going to be winners, and that's the idea. The only thing that can oppose an idea is a counter idea, an alternative idea, a counterculture to fight the dominant culture. So the first thing you have to do, it's a psychological struggle, it's an ideological struggle, is convincing people of the reality. One, there is class. Classes do exist, even though it's invisible. And two, unless you do something with a lot of other people together, you're going to be in this working class for the rest of your life. The phenomenon of what one famous book in the 1890s said was the phenomenon of progress and poverty. On the one hand, you have phenomenal progress, but you also have mass poverty, which is being created not necessarily by the progress or the technological innovation itself, but by the fact that the wealth is not shared. So eventually, the problem is not a technological problem. Eventually, the problem is not an engineering problem. Eventually, the problem is a political problem, because the wealth is not equitably distributed. So you have to have a political solution. We have had the possibility of distributing the wealth in a more equitable way for a long, long, long time. In 1948, President Harry Truman, in his State of the Union address of January 1948, essentially called for a guaranteed minimum income for all Americans, and that's in 1948. In the 1970s, with Richard Nixon as president, Richard Nixon also advocates a guaranteed minimum income to all Americans. The Republican Richard Nixon said, we're going to do this. We have the capacity to do this. It was killed in Congress through a coalition of course, Republicans in Congress. And radical lefties said the proposed minimum income, it's ridiculous. It's too low. It should be much, much higher than that. So between leftist opposition and right-wing opposition, that idea was killed 40 years ago. So we have actually had the capacity, the technological capacity, 40 years ago under Nixon. If you go back to 1948 with Harry Truman, he was also talking about those ideas. We have had, ever since World War II, the technological capacity to more equitably share the wealth. The problem has always been political. That's the problem, and it remains so today.
Yeah, that's a way to put it. Yeah. I think we also talked a bit about gig economy and about the monetization of structures and networks that were more about sharing and communal resource, like couch surfing or just the network of like friends and friends of friends. So whenever you were traveling, there was a floor you could sleep on, become like Airbnb. And that's destroying real estate and like the rental market in cities. And then also thinking about jitney cabs in Black neighborhoods where taxis wouldn't go, people creating their own, you know, rideshare structures. And now that's Uber, like, again, monetized and gig economy, where everyone's an independent contractor and no one's like actually making that much money. The companies that are organizing these structures are sucking a lot of that money off of the top. with Uber too. I'm like, is that pulling resource from public transit? I mean, public transit, for example, here in Pittsburgh is already pretty shoddy, you know, pay for a car than to like take the bus to the airport because it's going to take me 2 hours to go on the bus versus 30 minutes in a car, even if it's 10 times the cost. But, you know, is that just a cycle that's then keeping less resource from going into transit? And then people that can't afford to pay for the cars are like even more like left high and dry. Do you know, is it this like the cycle that's just perpetually like making that even worse? What's going to work for me right now? Trying to like put a band-aid or an enhancement on a system that's like fundamentally flawed and deeply broken. But then it's kind of like, where do we go from here? Like how can we still continue to build alternatives in different systems? And then how can we do that in a way that it's for everyone and not just for our own little like friend circle or subcultural circles? Yeah, I don't know.
You should be standing on the sidewalk next to Uber Advanced Technology Group, a large gray brick building. Look through the windows at the people, their computers, etc. What do you see? On that side of the glass, they're constructing pieces of the new economy. New economic structures are being formed from the technologies they are working on. Our lives will undoubtedly be changed in the future by their actions today. And while they are creating, who is creating the social structures we will need in this new world? In creating this audio walk, I wanted to connect both physically and intellectually the largely forgotten uprising of 1877 with the now technological and economic changes. These changes are happening right where you're standing, because if we don't create new social structures to adapt to the new economic and technological reality, it will become very ugly. Knowing what you do now, what do you want to ask them? Or, more importantly, what are the questions we should be asking ourselves that they are not? I'd like to give special thanks to historians Richard Ostreicher, Eric Leif Davin, and Staunton Lind, members of the Halley Mob Society, Mary Tremonti, and John Slifer. They are also both members of the Just Seeds Artist Cooperative. Voice narration for the newspapers was done by Nika Ross. Music by Danny Bracken. If you're looking for more information about the Great Strike of 1877, I highly recommend Eric Leif Davin's fictionalized account, The Great Strike of 1877, along with two additional books, Robert Bruce, 1877 Year of Violence, and Philip Foner's The Great Labor Uprising of 1877. Additional thanks to Natalia Pinchuk, Richard Randall, Meredith Maloney, Rich Pell, Lauren Allen, Sophia Catano, Elliot Sheedy, Alex Young, Lindsay French, Willie Smart, Jennifer Hayes, John Farinelli, Paolo Pedercini, and Tenley Schmida.